Why are our movies so bad, others so good? I will not dispute the assumption. I think our movies are shockingly bad, although in the past year there were a few we didn't need to be ashamed of. The basic answer to the question, you here in Southern California are certainly in a geographical position at least to answer. I think it would be wasting your time if I explained the financial structure of Hollywood, the psychology involved in big pictures, or the way the industry crushes individuality and personal expression. I assume you would not be here if you were not already familiar with the problems. I would like to talk instead about areas of failure outside the industry, about the collapse of film criticism in this country, so that there are almost no intelligent guides, either for audiences or for filmmakers, and about why our young filmmakers make spitballs instead of movies. I will not discuss our daily press and its effects on movies. Our daily press is beneath discussion. I am concerned with the collapse of values of our serious young critics and filmmakers. There are only two serious film magazines in America, Film Culture in New York, Film Quarterly in California. Though I have been published in both, I have very little respect for either. Film Quarterly is semi-academic and may be construed as a kind of shadow of the British Film Institute Sight and Sound. But Film Culture, which is a truly megalomaniac enterprise, the voice of the independent filmmakers, is a symptom of something very disturbing that I think may help to explain why young Frenchmen and Italians go out to shoot good movies and why young Americans don't. Film Culture has ties not only with the New York Film Bulletin and the Village Voice, but with the young critics in England centered at Oxford who put out the handsome magazine Movie. These are the young voices in Anglo-American film criticism. They also affect older voices, like Arthur Knight and Dwight MacDonald, who, perhaps afraid of not keeping up with the younger generation, have taken over some of their views. Their position is, I think, deadly to film art, and I want to examine it in some detail. What holds their judgments together is something called the auteur theory, a theory developed in France and now adapted for English and American purposes. Even if you have never heard of the theory, you have probably caught some of its echoes in the extraordinary praise a number of reviewers now lavish on films by Joseph Losey, Samuel Fuller, Nicholas Ray, Minnelli, John Ford, Otto Preminger, Howard Hawks, Leo McCarey, and others like Robert Aldrich. You heard its echo when Arthur Knight wrote that Whatever Happened to Baby Jane achieves its goals with something breathlessly close to perfection. If you are not familiar with the theory, it may be necessary for you to give me rather close attention for the next few minutes, as I propose to analyze it in some detail, taking as a text for analysis Andrew Sarris' article, Notes on the Auteur Theory in 1962, in the current issue of Film Culture. Mr. Sarris outlines the three premises, or three circles, as he calls them, of the auteur theory in these words. The first premise of the auteur theory is the technical competence of a director as a criterion of value. The second premise of the auteur theory is the distinguishable personality of the director as a criterion of value. The third and ultimate premise of the auteur theory is concerned with interior meaning, the ultimate glory of the cinema as an art. Interior meaning is extrapolated from the tension between a director's personality and his material. End quote. And Sarris concludes his article on this theory with this paragraph, quote, "Sometimes a great deal of corn must be husked to yield a few kernels of internal meaning. I recently saw Every Night at Eight, one of the many maddeningly routine films Raoul Walsh has directed in his long career. This 1935 effort featured George Raff, Alice Faye, Francis Langford, and Patsy Kelly in one of those familiar plots about radio shows of the period. The film keeps moving along in the pleasantly unpretentious manner one would expect of Walsh until one incongruously intense scene with George Raff thrashing about in his sleep, revealing his inner fears in mumbling dream talk. The girl he loves comes into the room in the midst of his unconscious avowals of feeling and listens sympathetically. This unusual scene was later amplified in High Sierra, with Humphrey Bogart and Ita Lupino. The point is that one of the screen's most virile directors employed an essentially feminine narrative device to dramatize the emotional vulnerability of his heroes. If I had not been aware of Walsh in Every Night at Eight, the crucial link to High Sierra would have passed unnoticed. Such are the joys of the auteur theory. That was the concluding paragraph of Mr. Sarris' article, and I should like to analyze it in some detail. I think perhaps a little more corn should be husked. Perhaps, for example, we can husk away the word internal. Is internal meaning any different from meaning? We might ask why the link is crucial. Is it because the device was incongruously intense in Every Night at Eight, and so demonstrated a try for something deeper on Walsh's part? But if his merit is his pleasantly unpretentious manner, that is to say, I suppose, that recognizing the limitations of the script, he wasn't trying to do much, then the incongruous device was probably a misconceived attempt that disturbed the manner, like a bad playwright interrupting a comedy scene because he cannot resist the opportunity to tug at your heartstrings. We might also ask why this narrative device is essentially feminine. Is it more feminine than masculine to be asleep, or to talk in one's sleep, or to reveal feelings? Or possibly does Sarris regard the device as feminine because the listening woman becomes a sympathetic figure, and emotional understanding is, in this virile context, assumed to be essentially feminine? Perhaps only if one accepts the narrow notions of virility so common in our action films can this sequence be seen as essentially feminine. And it is amusing that a critic can both support these clichés of the male world and be so happy when they are violated. This is how we might quibble with a different kind of critic. But we would never get anywhere with Sarris if we tried to examine what he is saying sentence by sentence. So let us ask, what is the meaning of the passage? Sarris has noticed that in High Sierra, not, in my opinion, a very good movie, Raoul Walsh repeated an uninteresting and obvious device that he had earlier used in a worse movie. And for some inexplicable reason, Sarris concludes that he would not have had this joy of discovery without the auteur theory. But in every art form, critics traditionally notice and point out the way the artists borrow from themselves as well as from others, and how the same devices, techniques, and themes reappear in their work. This is obvious in listening to music, seeing plays, reading novels, watching actors. We take it for granted that this is how we perceive the development or the decline of an artist. And it may be necessary to point out to auteur critics that repetition without development is decline. When you see Hitchcock's Saboteur, there is no doubt that he drew heavily and clumsily from the 39 steps. And when you see North by Northwest, you can see that he is once again toying with the ingredients of the 39 steps, and apparently having a good time with them. Would Sarris not notice the repetition in the Walsh films without the auteur theory? Or shall we take the more cynical view, that without some possible commitment to Walsh as an auteur, he probably wouldn't be spending his time looking at these movies? If we may be permitted a literary analogy, we can visualize Sarris researching in the archives of the Saturday Evening Post, tracing the development of Clarence Buttington Kellen, who, by the application of something like the auteur theory, would emerge as a much more important writer than Dostoevsky. For in Kellen's case, Sarris' three circles, the three premises of the theory, have been consistently congruent. Surely Kellen is technically competent, even pleasantly unpretentious. No writer has a more distinguishable personality, and if interior meaning is what can be extrapolated from, say, Hatari, or Advise and Consent, or whatever happened to Baby Jane, then surely Kellen's stories, with their attempts to force a bit of character and humor into the familiar plot outlines, are loaded with it. Poor misguided Dostoevsky, too full of what he has to say to bother with technical competence, and tackling important themes in each work, surely the worst crime in the auteur book, and with his almost incredible unity of personality and material, leaving you nothing to extrapolate from, he'd never make it. If the editors of movie ranked authors the way they do directors, Dostoevsky would probably be in that almost untouchable category of the ambitious. It should be pointed out that Sarah's defense of the auteur theory is based not only on his premises, but on a rather odd form of pragmatism, as in this statement, quote, "Thus to argue against the auteur theory in America is to assume that we have anyone of André Bazin's sensibility and dedication to provide an alternative, and we simply don't," end quote. Which I take to mean that the auteur theory is necessary in lieu of a critic who wouldn't need it. This is a new approach to aesthetics, and I hope Sarah's humility does not camouflage the double-edged thrust of his argument. If his aesthetics is based on expediency, then it may be expedient to point out that it takes extraordinary intelligence and discrimination and taste to use any theory in the arts, and that without those qualities, a theory becomes a rigid formula, which is indeed what is happening among auteur critics. The greatness of critics like André Bazin in France and James Agee in America may have something to do with their using their full range of intelligence and intuition, rather than relying on formulas. For surely criticism is an art, not a science, and a critic who follows rules will fail in one of his most important functions, perceiving what is original and important in new work and helping others to see. And now I'd like to examine in some detail these premises of the auteur theory. The first one of the outer circle is the technical competence of a director as a criterion of value. This seems less the premise of a theory than a commonplace of judgment, as Sarris himself indicates when he paraphrases it as, "A great director has to be at least a good director." But this commonplace, though it sounds reasonable and basic, is a very shaky premise. Sometimes the greatest artists in a medium bypass or violate the simple technical competence that is so necessary for hack. For example, it is extremely doubtful if Antonioni could handle a routine directorial assignment of the type at which John Sturges is so proficient, like Escape from Fourth Bravo or Bad Day at Black Rock. But surely Antonioni's La Ventura is the work of a great director. And the greatness of a director like Cocteau has nothing to do with mere technical competence. His greatness is in being able to achieve his own personal expression and style. And just as there were writers like Melville or Dreiser who triumphed over various kinds of technical incompetence and who were as artists incomparably greater than the facile technicians of their day, a new great film director may appear whose very greatness is in his struggling toward grandeur or in massive accumulation of detail. An artist who is not a good technician can indeed create new standards, because standards of technical competence are based on comparisons with work already done. Just as new work in other arts is often attacked because it violates the accepted standards and thus seems crude and ugly and incoherent, great new directors are very likely to be condemned precisely on the grounds that they're not even good directors, that they don't know their business. Which in some cases is true, but does it matter when that business has little to do with what they want to express in film? It may even be a hindrance, leading them to banal slickness instead of discovery of their own methods. For some, at least, Cocteau may be right. The only technique worth having is the technique you invent for yourself. The director must be judged on the basis of what he produces, his film. And if he can make great films without knowing the standard methods, without the usual craftsmanship of a good director, then that is the way he works. I would amend Sarris's first premise too. In works of a lesser rank, technical competence can help to redeem the weaknesses of the material. And it seems to be precisely this category that the auteur critics are most interested in, the routine material that a good craftsman can make into a fast and enjoyable movie. What, however, makes the auteur critics so incomprehensible is not merely their preferences for works of this category. In this, they merely follow the lead of children, who also prefer simple action films and westerns and horror films to works that make demands on their understanding. But their truly astonishing inability to exercise taste and judgment within their area of preference. Movie-going kids are, I think, much more reliable guides to this kind of movie than the auteur critics. Every kid I've talked to knows that North to Alaska was a surprisingly funny, entertaining movie, and Hatari, an auteur masterpiece, a terrible bore. And now the second premise of the auteur theory, the distinguishable personality of the director as a criterion of value. Up to this point, there has really been no theory. And now when Saris begins to work on his foundation, the entire edifice of civilized standards of taste collapses while he's tacking down his floorboards. Traditionally, in any art, the personalities of all those involved in a production have been a factor in judgment. But that the distinguishability of personality should be a criterion of value completely confuses normal judgment. The smell of a skunk is more distinguishable than the perfume of a rose. Does that make it better? Hitchcock's personality is certainly more distinguishable in Dial M for Murder, Rear Window, and Vertigo than Carol Reed's in The Stars Look Down, Odd Man Out, The Fallen Idol, The Third Man, and Outcast to the Islands, if for no other reason than because Hitchcock repeats while Reed tackles new subject matter. But how does this distinguishable personality function as a criterion for judging the work? We recognize the hands of Carnet and Prévert in Le Jour se lève, but that is not what makes it a beautiful film. We can just as easily recognize their hands in Port of Shadows, which is not such a good film. We can recognize that Le Plaisir and The Earrings of Madame Deux are both the work of Max Ophüls, but Le Plaisir is not a great film, and Madame Deux is. Often the works in which we are most aware of the personality of the director are his worst films, when he falls back on the devices he has already done to death. When a famous director makes a good movie, we look at the movie. We don't think about the director's personality. When he makes a stinker, we notice his familiar touches, because there's not much else to watch. When Preminger makes an expert, entertaining whodunit like Laura, we don't look for his personality. It has become part of the texture of the film. When he makes an atrocity like Whirlpool, there's plenty of time to look for his personality, if that's your idea of a good time. It could even be argued, I think, that Hitchcock's uniformity, his mastery of tricks, and his cleverness at getting audiences to respond according to his calculations, the feedback he wants and gets from them, reveal not so much a personal style as a personal theory of audience psychology, that his methods and approach are not those of an artist, but a prestidigitator. The auteur critics respond just as Hitchcock expects the gullible to respond. This is not so surprising. Often the works auteur critics call masterpieces are ones that seem to reveal the contempt of the director for the audience. It's hard to believe that Saris seriously attempts to apply the distinguishable personality of the director as a criterion of value, because when this premise becomes troublesome, he just tries to brazen his way out of difficulties. For example, now that John Huston's work has gone flat, Saris casually dismisses him with, quote, "Huston is virtually a forgotten man with a few actors' classics behind him," end quote. If The Maltese Falcon, perhaps the most high-style thriller ever made in America, a film Huston both wrote and directed, is not a director's film, what is? And if the distinguishable personality of the director is a criterion of value, then how can Saris dismiss the Huston who comes through so unmistakably in The Treasure of Sierra Madre, The African Queen, or Beat the Devil, or even in a muddled Huston film like Key Largo? If these are actors' movies, then what on earth is a director's movie? It's amusing to note that when it suits his convenience, Saris believes that it is the actors rather than the director who provide the criterion of value. Isn't the auteur theory a hindrance to clear judgment of Huston's movies and of his career? Disregarding the theory, we see some fine film achievements, and we perceive a remarkably distinctive directorial talent. We also see intervals of weak, half-hearted assignments like Across the Pacific and In This Our Life. Then, after Moulin Rouge, except for the blessing of Beat the Devil, we see a career that splutters out in ambitious failures like Moby Dick and confused projects like The Roots of Heaven and strictly commercial projects like Heaven Knows Mr. Ellison. And this kind of career seems more characteristic of film history, especially in the United States, than the ripening development and final mastery posited by the auteur theory, a theory that makes it almost de rigueur to regard Hitchcock's American films as superior to his early English films. Is Huston's career so different, say, from Fritz Lang's? How is it that Huston's early good, almost great work must be rejected along with his mediocre recent work? But Fritz Lang, being sanctified as an auteur, has his bad recent work praised along with his good. Employing more usual norms, if you respect the Fritz Lang who made M and You Only Live Once, if you enjoy the excesses of style and the magnificent absurdities of a film like Metropolis, then it is only good sense to reject the ugly stupidity of Journey to the Lost City. It is an insult to an artist to praise his bad work as much as his good. It indicates that you are incapable of judging either. A few years ago, Albert Johnson, in a newspaper review of John Renoir's University of California production of his play Carola, hailed it as a work of genius. When I asked Johnson how he could so describe this very unfortunate play, he said, "Why, of course it's a work of genius. Renoir is a genius, so anything he does is a work of genius." This could almost be a capsule version of the auteur theory. Just substitute Hatari for Carola. And in this reductio ad absurdum, viewing a work is superfluous, as the judgment is a priori. This is not so far from the way auteur critics work, either. Sarris doesn't even play his own game with any decent attention to the rules. It is as absurd to praise Long's recent bad work as to dismiss Huston's early good work. Surely it would be more consistent if he also tried to make a case for Huston's bad pictures. That would be more consistent than devising a category called Actors' Classics to explain his good pictures away. If The Maltese Falcon and The Treasure of Sierra Madre are Actors' Classics, then what makes Hawks to Have and Have Not and The Big Sleep, which were obviously tailored to the personalities of Bogart and Bacall, the work of an auteur? Sarris believes that what makes an auteur is an élan of the soul. This critical language is barbarous. Where else should élan come from? It's like saying a digestion of the stomach. A film critic need not be a theoretician, but it is necessary that he know how to use words. This might indeed be a first premise for a theory. Those who have this élan presumably have it forever, and their films reveal the organic unity of the director's careers. And those who don't have it, well, they can only make Actors' Classics. It's ironic, isn't it, that a critic trying to establish simple objective rules as a guide for critics who he thinks aren't gifted enough to use taste and intelligence ends up where actually he began, with a theory based on mystical insight, which might really make demands on the auteur critics if they did not simply take the easy way out of arbitrary decisions of who's got it and who hasn't. Their decisions are not merely not based on their theory, their decisions are beyond criticism. It's like a woman's telling us that she feels a certain dress does something for her. Her feeling has about as much to do with critical judgment as the auteur critic's feeling that Minnelli has it, but Huston never had it. This it is not supposed to be affected by the vicissitudes of fortune, the industrial conditions of movie making, the turmoil of a country, or the health of a director. Indeed, Sarris says, quote, "If directors and other artists cannot be wrenched from their historical environment, aesthetics is reduced to a subordinate branch of ethnography," end quote. May I suggest that if in order to judge movies, the auteur critics must wrench the directors from their historical environment, which is, to put it mildly, impossible, so that they can concentrate on the detection of that élan, they are reducing aesthetics to a form of idiocy. Sarris experiences joy when he recognizes a pathetic little link between two Raoul Walsh pictures. He never does explain whether the discovery makes him think the pictures are any better. But he wants to see artists in a pristine state, their essences perhaps, separated from all the life that has formed them and to which they try to give expression. The inner circle in this theory, the third and ultimate premise of the auteur theory, is, according to Sarris, concerned with interior meaning, the ultimate glory of the cinema as an art. interior meaning is extrapolated from the tension between a director's personality and his material. This is a remarkable formulation. It is the opposite of what we have always taken for granted in the arts, that the artist expresses himself in the unity of form and content. What Sarris believes to be the ultimate glory of the cinema as an art is what has generally been considered the frustrations of a man working against the given material. Fantastic as his formulation is, it does something that the first two premises didn't do. It does clarify the interests of the auteur critic. If we have been puzzled because the auteur critic seems so deeply involved, even dedicated, in becoming connoisseurs of trash, now we can see by this theoretical formulation that trash is indeed their chosen province of film. Their ideal auteur is the man who signs a long-term contract, directs any script that's handed to him, and expresses himself by shoving bits of style up the crevasses of the plot. If his style is in conflict with the storyline or subject matter, so much the better. More chance for tension. Now we can see why there has been so much use of the term personality in this aesthetics, the word which seems so inadequate when discussing the art of Griffith or Renoir or Murnau or Dreyer is indeed suitable, because a routine commercial movie can sure use a little personality. Now that we have reached the inner circle, with its empty socket for a bull's eye, we can see why the shoddiest films are often praised the most. Subject matter is irrelevant, so long as it isn't treated sensitively, which is bad, and will quickly be disposed of by auteur critics who know that the smart director isn't responsible for that anyway. They'll get on to the important subject, his mise-en-scene. The director who fights to do something he cares about is a square. Now we can at least begin to understand why there was such contempt at Houston for what was in its way a rather extraordinary effort, the Moby Dick that failed. Why Movie considers Roger Corman a better director than Fred Zinnemann and ranks Joseph Losey next to God. Why Peter Bogdanovich, Jonas Mekas, and Andrew Sarris give their highest critical ratings to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Mighty big crevasses there. If Carol Reed had only made movies like The Man Between, in which he obviously worked to try to make something out of a rag bag of worn-out bits of material, he might be considered brilliant too. But this is doubtful, as even the worst Carol Reed is infinitely superior to Robert Aldrich's Baby Jane. Carol Reed would probably be detected and rejected as a man of substance. I am angry, but am I unjust? Here, Sarris, I quote, "A cuker who works with all sorts of projects has a more developed abstract style than an Ingmar Bergman, who is free to develop his own script. Not that Bergman lacks personality, but his work has declined with the depletion of his ideas, largely because his technique never equaled his sensibility. Joseph L. Mankiewicz and Billy Wilder are other examples of writer-directors without adequate technical mastery. By contrast, Douglas Sirk and Otto Preminger have moved up the scale because their miscellaneous projects reveal a stylistic consistency." End quote. How neat it all is. Bergman's work has declined with the depletion of his ideas, largely because his technique never equaled his sensibility. But what on earth does that mean? How did Sarris perceive Bergman's sensibility except through his technique? Is Sarris saying what he seems to be saying, that if Bergman had developed more technique, his work wouldn't be dependent on his ideas? I'm afraid this is what he means, and that when he refers to Cukor's more developed abstract style, he means by abstract something unrelated to ideas, a technique not dependent on the content of the film. This is curiously reminiscent of a view common enough in the business world, that it's better not to get too involved, too personally interested in business problems, or they take over your life, and besides, you don't function as well when you've lost your objectivity. But this is the opposite of how an artist works. His technique, his style, is determined by his range of involvement and his preference for certain themes. Cukor's style is no more abstract than Ingmar Bergman's. Cukor has a range of subject matter that he can handle and when he gets a good script within his range, like the Philadelphia Story or Pat and Mike, he does a good job. But he is at an immense artistic disadvantage compared with Bergman, because he is dependent on the ideas of so many and often bad scriptwriters, and on material which is often alien to his talent. It's amusing, but also depressing, to see the way auteur critics tend to downgrade writer-directors, who are in the best position to use the film medium for personal expression. Saras does some pretty fast shuffling with John Huston and Ingmar Bergman. Why doesn't he just come out and admit that writer-directors are disqualified by his third premise? They can't arrive at that interior meaning, the ultimate glory of the cinema as an art, because a writer-director has no tension between his personality and his material, so there's nothing for the auteur critic to extrapolate from. What is all this nonsense about extrapolating interior meaning from the tension between a director's personality and his material? A competent commercial director generally does the best he can with what he's got to work with. Where is the tension? And if you can locate some, what kind of meaning could you draw out of it? Except that the director is having a bad time with lousy material or material he doesn't like. Or maybe he's trying to speed up the damned production so that he can do something else that he has some hopes for. Are these critics honestly and futilely looking for interior meaning, or is this just some form of intellectual diddling that helps to sustain their pride while they're viewing silly movies? Where is the tension in John Hawke's films? When he has good material, he's capable of better than good direction, as he demonstrates in films like 20th Century, Bringing Up Baby, and His Girl Friday. And in films like To Have and Have Not and The Big Sleep, he demonstrates that with help from the actors, he can jazz up ridiculous scripts. But what interior meaning, or just plain meaning, can be extrapolated from an enjoyable, harmless piece of kitsch like Only Angels Have Wings? What can the auteur critic see in it beyond the sex and glamour and fantasies of the high school boys' universe? Exactly what the mass audience liked it for. And when Hawke's material or his cast is dull, and when his heart isn't in the production, when by the auteur theory he should show his personality, the result is something soggy, like The Big Sky. George Cukor's modest statement, "Give me a good script, and I'll be 100 times better as a director," provides some notion of how a director may experience the problem of the given material. In another sense, it is perhaps immodest. I would say give Cukor a script with good light dialogue, and he will know what to do with it. But I wouldn't expect more than good, glossy entertainment. It seems almost too obvious to mention it, but can Saras really discern the distinguishable personality of George Cukor and his abstract style in films like Bhowani Junction, Les Girls, The Actress, A Life of Her Own, The Model and the Marriage Broker, Edward My Son, A Woman's Face, Romeo and Juliet, A Double Life? I wish I could put Saras to the test. I can only suspect that many auteur critics would have a hard time seeing those telltale traces of the beloved in their work. What can a man like Cukor do with a script like the Chapman Report but try to kid it, to dress it up a bit, to show off the talents of Jane Fonda and Claire Bloom and Glynis Johns, and to give the total production a little flair and craftsmanship? At best, he can make an entertaining bad movie. A director with something like magical gift can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. But if he has it in him to do more in life than making silk purses, the triumph is minor, even if the purse is lined with gold. Only by the use of the auteur theory does this little victory become ultimate glory. For some unexplained reason, those traveling in auteur circles believe that making that purse out of that sow's ear is an infinitely greater accomplishment than making a good solid carrying case out of a good piece of leather, as, for example, Fred Zinnemann does with films like From Here to Eternity or The Nun Story. I suppose we should be happy for Douglas Sirk and Otto Preminger, elevated up the auteur glory scale, but I suspect that the stylistic consistency of, say, Preminger could be a matter of his limitations, and that the only way you could tell he made some of his movies was that he used the same players so often. Linda Darnell, Gene Crane, Gene Tierney, Dana Andrews gave his movies the Preminger look. But the argument is ludicrous anyway, because if Preminger shows stylistic consistency, with subject matter as varied as Carmen Jones, Anatomy of a Murder, and Advise and Consent, then by any rational standards he should be attacked rather than elevated. I don't think these films are stylistically consistent, nor do I think Preminger is a great director, for the very simple reason that his films are consistently superficial and facile, and Advise and Consent, an auteur masterpiece, is, I think, less than facile. An editorial in Movies states, quote, "In order to enjoy Preminger's films, the spectator must apply an unprejudiced intelligence. He is constantly required to examine the quality not only of the character's decisions, but also of his own reactions. And Preminger presupposes an intelligence active enough to allow the spectator to make connections, comparisons, and judgments." End quote. May I suggest that this spectator would have better things to do than the editors of Movie who put out Preminger issues. They may have, of course, the joys of discovering links between Centennial Summer, Forever Amber, That Lady in Ermine, and The 13th Letter, but I refuse to believe in these ever-so-intellectual protestations. The auteur critics are not a very convincing group. I assume that Sarah's theory is not based on his premises. The necessary causal relationships are absent, but rather that the premises were devised in a clumsy attempt to prop up the theory. It's a good thing he stopped at 3. A few more circles and we'd really be in hell, which might turn out to be the last refinement of film taste, Abbott and Costello comedies, perhaps. These critics work embarrassingly hard trying to give some semblance of intellectual respectability to a preoccupation with mindless, repetitious commercial products, the kind of action movies that the restless, rootless men who wander on 42nd Street and in the tenderloin of all our big cities have always preferred, just because they could respond to them without thought. These movies soak up your time. I would suggest that they don't serve a very different function for Saras or Bogdanovich or the young men of Movie, even though they devise elaborate theories to justify soaking up their time. An educated man has to work pretty hard to set his intellectual horizons at the level of I Was a Male War Bride, an auteur masterpiece which, incidentally, wasn't even a good commercial movie. Interior meaning seems to be what those in the know. It's a mystique and a mistake. The auteur critics never tell us by what divining rods they have discovered the elan of a Manelli or a Nicholas Ray or a Leo McCarey. They're not critics, they're inside dopesters. There must be another circle that Sarah's forgot to get to, the one where the secrets are kept. And now I should like to go outside this theory for a moment, outside circles, and ask, what is a film critic? Now, I suspect that there is some primitive form of Platonism in the underbrush of Sarah's aesthetics. This might help to explain such rather quaint statements as, quote, "Bazan was, if anything, generous to a fault, seeking in every film some vestige of the cinematic art," end quote. As if cinema were not simply the movies that have been made and are being made, but some pre-existent entity. Sarah says, for example, that Bazan's greatness as a critic rested in his disinterested conception of the cinema as a universal entity, end quote. I don't know what a universal entity is, but I rather imagine Bazan's stature as a critic has less to do with universals than with intelligence, knowledge, experience, sensitivity, perceptions, fervor, imagination, dedication, lucidity, and so forth, the traditional qualities associated with great critics. The role of the critic is to help people see what is in the work, what is in it that shouldn't be, what is not in it that could be. He is a good critic if he helps people understand more about the work than they could see for themselves. He is a great critic if by his understanding and feeling for the work, if by his passion, he can excite people so that they want to experience more of the art that is there, waiting to be seized. He is not a bad critic if he makes errors in judgment. Infallible taste is inconceivable. What could it be measured against? He is a bad critic if he does not awaken the curiosity, enlarge the interest and understanding of his audience. The art of the critic is to transmit his knowledge and enthusiasm for art to others. I do not understand what goes on in the mind of a critic who thinks a theory is what his colleagues need because they are not great critics. Any honest man can perform the critical function to the limits of his taste and powers. I dare say that Peter Bogdanovich and V.F. Perkins and R.M. Franke and Mark Shivas and all the rest of the new breed of specialists know more about movies than some people, and could serve at least a modest critical function if they could remember that art is an expression of human experience. If they are men of feeling and intelligence, isn't it time for them to be a little ashamed of their detailed criticism of movies like River of No Return? What is the appeal of this theory? If relatively sound, reasonably reliable judgments were all that we wanted from film criticism, then Sight and Sound might be considered a great magazine. It isn't. It's something far less. A good, dull, informative, well-written, safe magazine. The best film magazine in English, but it doesn't satisfy desires for an excitement of the senses. Its critics don't often outrage us, neither do they open much up for us. Its intellectual range is too narrow, its approach too professional. If we recall an article or review, it's almost impossible to remember which Peter or which Derek wrote it. Standards of quality are not enough, and Sight and Sound tends to dampen enthusiasm. Movie, by contrast, has vitality and a refreshing willingness to take chances, even though the articles, based on its official auteur position, reduce movies to trivia. It is not merely that the auteur theory distorts experience. All theory does that, and helps us to see more sharply for having done so, but that it is an aesthetics which is fundamentally anti-art. And this, I think, is the most serious charge that can possibly be brought against an aesthetic. The auteur theory, which probably helped to liberate the energies of the French critics, plays a very different role in England and with the film culture in New York Film Bulletin auteur critics in the United States, an anti-intellectual, anti-art role. I have discussed the background of this situation on the radio before. If you have heard me go over this ground a bit, please be indulgent. I think we need to cover it a little bit to make this position clear. The French auteur critics, rejecting the socially conscious problem picture so dear to the older generation of American critics, became connoisseurs of values in American pictures that Americans took for granted, and if they were educated Americans, often held in contempt. The French adored the gangster pictures and the vitality, the strength of our action films. In one sense, the French were perfectly right. These were often much more skillfully made and far more interesting visually than the movies with a message, which Americans were so proud of and considered so adult. Where the French went off was in finding elaborate intellectual and psychological meanings in these simple action movies. No doubt we make some comparable mistakes in interpreting French films. Like most swings of the critical pendulum, the theory was a corrective, and it helped to remind us of the energies and crude strength and good humor that Europeans enjoyed in our movies. The French saw something in our films that their own lacked. They admired it, and to some degree they have taken it over and used it in their own way. Triumphantly and breathless and in Shoot the Piano Player, not very successfully in their semi-American thrillers. But for us the situation is different. It is good for us to be reminded that our mass culture is not altogether poisonous in its effect on other countries, but the industrial products of Hollywood that we grew up on are not enough to satisfy our interests as we become adults. We want a great deal more from our movies than we get from the John Ford westerns that Europeans adore. I enjoy some movies by Howard Hawks and Henry Hathaway, but I wouldn't be much interested in the film medium if that were all that movies could be. We see many elements in foreign films that our movies lack. We also see that our films have lost the beauty and innocence and individuality that they had before the mechanization of Hollywood became so total. There was no special reason for the French critics, preoccupied with their needs, to become sensitive to ours. And it was not surprising that in France, where film directors work in circumstances more comparable to those of a dramatist or a composer, critics would become fixated on American directors, seeing them as the authors or auteurs of the film, not understanding how confused and inextricable are the roles of the front office, the producers, writers, editors, and all the rest in Hollywood. In a sense, the name of a director is a guide on what American films to see. If a director is associated with a certain type of film that the French liked, or if a director's work showed the speed and vigor that they enjoyed, of course they wanted to see more work by him. I assume that anyone interested in movies uses the director's name as some sort of guide, both positive and negative. For example, in the 40s, my friends and I would keep an eye out for the Robert Siodmak film, and we would avoid the Irving Rapper films, except when they starred Betty Davis, whom we wanted to see even in bad movies. I avoid Mervyn LeRoy films, though I went to see Home Before Dark for Gene Simmons' performance. I wish I could avoid Peter Glanville's pictures, but he uses actors I want to see. There is no rule or theory involved in any of this, just simple discrimination. We judge the man from his films and learn to predict a little about his next film. We don't judge the films from the man. But what has happened to the judgment of the English and New York critics who have taken over the auteur theory and used it to erect a film aesthetic based on those commercial movies that answered a need for the French, but which are not merely ludicrously inadequate to our needs, but are the results of a system of production that places a hammerlock on American directors? And how can they, with straight faces, probe for deep meanings in these products? Even the kids they're made for know enough not to take them seriously. How can these critics, sensible enough to deflate our overblown message movies, reject the total content of a work as unimportant and concentrate on signs of a director's personality and interior meaning? It's understandable that they're trying to find movie art in the loopholes of commercial production. It's a harmless hobby, and we all play it now and then. What's incomprehensible is that they prefer their loopholes to unified film expression. If they weren't determined to exalt products over works that attempt to express human experience, wouldn't they have figured out that the mise-en-scene which they seek out in these products, the director's personal style, which comes through despite the material, is only a mere suggestion, a hint, of what an artist can do when he's in control of the material, when the whole film becomes expressive? It must be black comedy for directors to read this new criticism and discover that films in which they felt trapped and disgusted are now said to be their masterpieces. It's an aesthetics for 1984. Failure is success. I am too far from the English scene to guess at motive, and far away also from New York, but perhaps close enough to guess that the Americans, or unconsciously, are making a kind of social comment. Like those who produce junk art, like the pop artists, the new realists, with their comic strips and Campbell soup can paintings, they are saying, "See what America is. This junk is a fact of our lives. Art and avant-gardism are phony. What isn't any good is good. Only squares believe in art. The artifacts of industrial civilization are the supreme truth, the supreme joke." This is a period, I think, when men who consider themselves creative scoff at art and tradition. It is perhaps no accident that in the same issue of Film Culture with Sarris Auteur Theory, there is a lavishly illustrated spread on the perfect filmic appositeness of Maria Montez, a fairly close movie equivalent for that outsized can of Campbell's soup. The editor, Jonas Mekas, has his kind of social comment. This is his approach to editing a film magazine. Quote, "As long as the lucidly minded critics will stay out, with all their form, content, art, structure, clarity, importance, everything will be all right. Just keep them out. For the new soul is still a bud, still going through its most dangerous, most sensitive stage." End quote. Doesn't exactly make one feel welcome, does it? I'm sure I don't know what the problem is. Are there so many lucidly minded critics in this country, like Andrew Sarris, perhaps, that they must be fought all? And aren't these little buds that have to be protected from critical judgment the same little filmmakers who are so convinced of their importance that they can scarcely conceive of a 5-minute film which doesn't end with what they no doubt regard as the ultimate social comment, the mushroom cloud rising. Those buds often behave more like tough nuts. Sarris, with his love of commercial trash, and Meccas, who writes of the cul-de-sac of Western culture which is stifling the spiritual life of man, seem to have irreconcilable points of view. Sarris, with his joys, and Raoul Walsh, seems a long way from Meccas, the spokesman for the independent filmmakers, who couldn't worm their way into Sarris' outside circle of technical competence. Meccas makes statements like, quote, "The new artist, by directing his ear inward, is beginning to catch bits of man's true vision," end quote. Dear Lon Chaney, Meccas, please get your ear out of your eye. Meccas has at least one thing in common with good directors. He likes to dramatize. But to love trash and to feel that you are stifled by it are perhaps very close positions. Does the man who paints the can of Campbell's soup love it or hate it? I think the answer is both, that he is obsessed by it as a fact of our lives and a symbol of America. A cynical reader of film culture may begin to wonder if Meccas' dedication to the new filmmakers is related to the new school of junk art. And Meccas announces, "I don't want any part of the big art game." When he says that, he comes even closer to Sarris. And doesn't the auteur theory fit nicely into the pages of an independent filmmaker's journal when you consider that the work of those filmmakers might compare very unfavorably with good films, but can look fairly interesting when compared with commercial products? It can even look original to those who don't know much film history. The independent filmmakers, Lord knows, are already convinced about their importance as the creative figures, the auteurs. A theory which suggested the importance of writing to film art might seriously damage their egos. They go even farther than the auteur critics' notion that the script is merely something to transcend. They often act as if anyone who's concerned with script is a square who doesn't dig film. Isn't the anti-art attitude of the auteur critics, both in England and here, implicit in their peculiar emphasis on virility? Walsh is, for Sarris, one of the screen's most virile directors. In Movie, we discover, quote, "When one talks about the heroes of Red River or Rio Bravo or Hatari, one is talking about Howard Hawks himself. Finally, everything that can be said in presenting Hawks boils down to one simple statement. Here is a man," end quote. I don't think critics would use terms like virile or masculine to describe artists like Dreyer or Renoir. There's something too limited about describing them this way. Just as when we describe a woman as sensitive and feminine, we are indicating her limitations. We might call Kipling a virile writer, but who would think of calling Shakespeare a virile writer? But for the auteur critics, calling a director virile is the highest praise, because I suggest it is some kind of assurance that he is not trying to express himself in an art form, but treats movie-making as a professional job. I quote from Movie again, "Hawks makes the very best adventure films because he is at one with his heroes. Only Raoul Walsh is as deeply an adventurer as Hawks. Hawks' heroes are all professionals doing jobs. Scientists, sheriffs, cattlemen, big game hunters. Real professionals who know their capabilities. They know exactly what they can do with the available resources, expecting of others only what they know can be given," end quote. The auteur critics are so enthralled with their narcissistic male fantasies. I quote from Movie again, "Because Hawks' films and their heroes are so genuinely mature, they don't need to announce the fact for all to hear," end quote. These critics are so enthralled with these fantasies, they seem unable to relinquish their schoolboy notions of human experience. If there are any female practitioners of auteur criticism, I have not yet discovered them. Justify staying inside the small range of experience of their boyhood and adolescence, that period when masculinity looked so great and important, but art was something talked about by posers and phonies and sensitive feminine types. And is it perhaps also their way of making a comment on our civilization by the theory that trash is the true film art? I ask I do not know.